Welcome to the African American Hour. I'm Byron Buckner, bringing you an hour of news, history, information, and commentary about the African American community. Today I'll have readings from the New York Times, the Religion News Service, the Pew Research Center, and I'm going to start with two stories from the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. The official theme for Black History Month in 2024 was African Americans in the Arts. And the Atlanta Journal-Constitution newspaper had a series of stories based on that theme that were published during the month of February. This is one of them. The title of the story is, White Actors Played Black Role. It took 200 years plus for an African-American man to be cast as Shakespeare's tragic Moor. It was written by Nancy Clanton and published February 9, 2024. Oh, the irony. In Shakespeare's Othello, envious Iago says to his boss, men should be what they seem, or those that be not, what they might seem none. The irony is the actor playing Othello, the dark-skinned Moor, was likely white. Today it makes sense for us to see James Earl Jones, Mickey Pfeiffer, Avery Brooks, and Augusta native Lawrence Fishburne play the part, but it wasn't always like that. There are likely many reasons fair-skinned men always got the role, one being a dearth of black actors in the 17th and 18th centuries. There was also the racist idea that black people lacked the ability to comprehend Shakespeare or project the emotions of the play. However, Ira Alridge's portrayal in 1825, touted as the first by a black actor, laid waste to that argument. The anti-abolitionist lobby claimed the slave population lacked the intellectual capacity to look after themselves. Tony Howard from England's Warwick University wrote, but the sight and sound of Alridge playing a great role on a hallowed stage defied that propaganda. Paul Robeson was the first African-American cast as Othello in a major production in the United States and the first black actor in the role since Alridge, according to the Harvard Library. His moment came in 1945. I think Shakespeare is something that a lot of black performers have found difficulty seeing themselves in, said Marlon Burnley, an assistant professor of directing at Kennesaw State University. You see Shakespeare and you say, oh, that's not for me, because historically, it's been white men playing those roles, doing these plays, and so it's kind of hard to get over that hump. Burnley landed the coveted role while a graduate student at the University of Georgia. He says he was very adamant about introducing Shakespeare to his students. We have a very diverse population, so it's important for me to help them find their place in this work, because I think it can be really useful for them, he said. I think it can be very empowering. Aldrich and Robeson found their place, despite the stereotype, even though it took 200 years to do it. Ira Aldrich. If you're not familiar with Ira Frederick Aldrich, you're most likely not alone. Few 19th century black actors are household names. Although Shakespeare's five-act play was first performed in 1604, Aldrich was not cast until 1825. For more than 200 years, white men portrayed the African general. Aldrich might have been the first black actor to play Othello, but Othello wasn't his first part. Born in New York City in 1807, he joined the African Grove Theater in his teens. The African Grove was run by and created by the black community. When they performed plays written by the Bard, including Richard III and Hamlet, the black actors, playing white characters, were beaten up on the orders of the rival theater managers, derided and arrested, Howard wrote. When the theater was burned to the ground, the performers took their act on the road. Aldrich made his way to England. Across the pond, he was considered either a hero or a villain. He performed mostly in abolitionist-friendly cities, where he was honored for his performances. This praise made him a target in the Covent Garden in London. When he took over the part of Othello at the Covent, critics objected to his race. his youth, and his inexperience, according to the Folger Shakespeare Library. Never truly accepted by London's elite, Aldrich began touring in 1852. He performed as far as Imperial Russia, including Poland and Ukraine, according to the British Library. Aldrich died in Lodz, Poland, just weeks after his 60th birthday. A long funeral procession crossed the city, with members of the local theater society carrying his medals and orders on red velvet cushions in a laurel wreath, while local people covered his grave with flowers, the library wrote. As lauded as Aldrich was in some parts of the world, it took another century before the second black actor recited Othello's monologues on a major stage. Paul Robeson. PBS described Robeson as the epitome of the 20th century Renaissance man. He was an exceptional athlete, actor, singer, cultural scholar, author, and political activist. Born in 1898 to an escaped slave turned minister and a woman from a distinguished Philadelphia family, Robeson earned a scholarship to Rutgers University, where he was class valedictorian. After getting his law degree from Columbia University Law School, he joined a firm in the early 1920s. That didn't last long, however, considering the political climate of the time and Robeson's activism. Robeson left that life and began one as an actor. He played the lead in both Eugene O'Neill's All God's Children Got Wings, 1924, and The Emperor Jones, 1925. He is also a singer, and his performance of Old Man River in 1936's Showboat is one most people recognize and know by heart. Cast as Othello on Broadway in 1942, his portrayal ran for nearly 300 performances and, according to PBS, is still considered one of the great American Shakespeare productions. His advocacy for desegregation of the military, abolishing anti-lynching laws, and other human rights causes led him to be labeled a communist. He was singled out by Senator Joseph McCarthy as a major threat to democracy. On June 12, 1956, Robeson testified before the House Committee on Un-American Activities, where he was questioned about his political speech, associations, and party affiliation. The committee revoked his passport, and it was 8 years before he could travel overseas again. But those years took their toll. He suffered from depression to the point he underwent shock treatment. Robeson retired to Philadelphia and lived in seclusion until his death in 1976. There were no plaques, awards, or flowers at the time. That was the article titled, White Actors Played Black Role. It took 200 years plus for an African-American man to be cast as Shakespeare's tragic Moor. It was written by Nancy Clanton and published February 9, 2024 in the Atlanta Journal-Constitution newspaper. My next reading is from the Atlanta Journal-Constitution's Black History Month series of stories that focused on African-Americans in the arts. The title of this story is Museums at Atlanta HBCUs Hold a World of Treasure. It was written by Mirtha Donastork and published February 4, 2024. The subtitle to the story is More than 1,600 works from some of the most influential black artists since the 1800s are in permanent collections. There's a treasure in the heart of the West End. It's been amassed over decades, but not hoarded. It isn't hidden away in some chest or safe, but is shown to the public, for free, at the art museums of Clark Atlanta University and Spelman College. This is a world treasure and people come from all over, said Danielle Taylor, the director of the CAU Art Museum. Case in point, a painting owned by the historically black college, Woman in Blue by William H. Johnson, is the featured image for the Harlem Renaissance and Transatlantic Modernism exhibition at New York's famed Metropolitan Museum of Art. It is one of five pieces from Clark Atlanta that will be in the Met's exhibit starting the end of February. 2 years ago, Clark Atlanta hosted an incredibly popular week-long exhibition of Jean-Michel Basquiat's early works. And the history of black art from the 19th, 20th and 21st centuries can be seen through the more than 1,600 objects. paintings, sculptures, textiles, murals, and more in the permanent collections of the Clark Atlanta and Spelman Museums. It's a history of oppression, of beauty, of survival, of making do, of surpassing circumstances. Art History of the AUC. The Clark Atlanta Museum has spent the past 8 decades collecting African American and diasporic art and has a significant collection from the period between the early 20th century Harlem Renaissance and the Civil Rights Movement. Works by Henry Osawa Tanner, who the Smithsonian calls the most distinguished African American artist of the 19th century, are part of both Spelman and Clark's collections. But before he was a famed painter, Tanner was a professor at Clark College from 1888 to 1890, long before Clark merged with Atlanta University to become CAU. While in Atlanta, Tanner met with a benefactor who sponsored a trip to Paris, where he grew his career and became the first Black American artist to receive international acclaim. In 1931, an influential artist would join the faculty of Atlanta University, Hale Woodruff. While a professor, Woodruff studied mural painting with the famed Mexican artist Diego Rivera. He would later paint 6 massive canvas panels, The Art of the Negro Murals, that depict the cultural history of African and indigenous art forms and their impact on Western art and have been studied by international scholars. The murals line the atrium of the CAU Art Museum, sitting above the card catalogs that nod to the space's former life as a library. But one of Woodruff's most significant contributions to the school was a juried competition that he started in 1942, the Atlanta Art Annual. The competition would go on every year until 1970, and in that time about 900 Black artists from around the country participated, and 291 of their works were purchased by the university, creating the foundation of the CAU collection. Woodruff's teaching and contributions to the Atlanta University Art Department boosted its prominence so much that it was considered at one point the École des Beaux-Arts of the Black South, according to the Smithsonian American Art Museum, a reference to the famed French school that produced renowned artists like Pierre-Auguste Renoir, Edgar Degas, and John Singer Sargent. CAU's collection now has more than 1,200 works and is likely worth more than $100 million, according to Taylor, though it will be reappraised soon. And the collections of the CAU and Spelman Museums reflect the missions of the institutions where they are based. I think this is a unique place because you can come and see world-class exhibitions for free, said Liz Andrews, executive director of the Spelman College Museum of Fine Art. You know that you will walk away with a deeper knowledge of history and contemporary topics with a focus on Black women. There's no place in the country that does that. Spelman has about 450 works in his permanent collection, primarily by Black female artists. It includes work by the contemporary painter and Spelman alumna Kalita Garcia Rawls and famed sculptor Elizabeth Catlett. Andrews says Spelman also has the largest collection of works by sculptor Selma Burke, the artist behind the portrait of President Franklin D. Roosevelt used on the dime. Spelman has the original relief that was miniaturized onto the coin. CAU and Spelman have also collected contemporary Atlanta artists like Fahamu Pacol, the late Radcliffe Bailey, Morehouse Professor Krista Clark, and Sheila Pre Bright. And the AUC has not just collected famous artists, but produced them as well. Amy Sherall, the artist behind the official portrait of the former First Lady Michelle Obama, attended Clark Atlanta and took painting classes at Spelman. An art history education. Despite decades of offering art education, the Atlanta University Center did not have an art history degree until 6 years ago, when the AUC Art History and Curatorial Studies Collective was launched. It was created in response to a 2015 study by the Andrew W. Mellon Foundation that found only 16% of American museum leadership positions were held by minorities, despite making up 38% of the population. Only 4% of leaders were Black and just 3% were Hispanic. In 2018, Spelman received a $5.4 million grant from the Walton Family Foundation that went toward establishing the AUC Art Collective. Late last year, the college renewed the grant, receiving this time $6.5 million for the next 3 years, according to Cheryl Finley, the collective's founding director. Art history is our legacy, said Finley. The collective offers an art history major and minor, as well as a minor in curatorial studies. Upperclassmen are placed in paid summer internships, and there is a summer early college program open to high school students around the world. Destiny Fillmore was one of the first graduates of the AUC Art Collective. She graduated from Spelman in 2021 with a degree in art history. During her time in the program, she interned at the Cleveland Museum of Art and was accepted into a prestigious curatorial fellowship for her graduate studies. Her journey to being a curator started in the Spelman Art Museum. Every freshman must take African Diaspora and the World classes, which brings them into the museum to write about a piece or a show. Fillmore was working on her paper when she saw professors speaking to a small group of students in the museum. She eavesdropped on the lesson when the professors invited her to join. A few weeks later, they invited her to an art history colloquium in Washington. It was so electrifying, I'd never gone to a conference like that, said Fillmore. I was kind of smitten since then. In January, she started a new job as an assistant curator at the Met, a rarity for a 25-year-old curator. The things I learned at Spelman, the connections that I've made, the relationships that I maintain, and really the sort of endless support that I've received from people is what made it possible for me, said Fillmore. Small but mighty. In the fall, Spelman held a show of 21 paintings and mixed media works by Harmonia Rosales, an Afro-Cuban-American artist. In one of the showstoppers of the exhibit, Rosales reimagined Michelangelo's Sistine Chapel. An overturned boat meant to represent slave ships served as the ceiling and was plastered with miniatures of her detailed gilded oil paintings that merged stories of West African Yoruba culture with Greek mythology and Christianity. Andrews placed a painting depicting the transatlantic slave trade, the migration of the gods, in the same room as the ship and on a wall that faced toward the Atlantic in a sort of prayerful meditation. On Friday, Spelman opened its latest exhibit, Threaded. It includes quilts from Spelman and Clark Atlanta's collections created by the Geese Bend Quilt Collective, an Alabama group of black female quilters who carried the tradition down from enslaved ancestors. The show goes through May 24th. The CAU Museum has on display an array of works from its permanent collection, CAU faculty, and an artist in residence. But the reality is, though mighty, these are small museums. I'm having to build this community that supports us financially. We're a little bit starting from scratch, said Clark Atlantis Taylor. But for Andrews, coming to the Spelman Art Museum from the much larger Los Angeles County Museum of Art in the fall of 2021 was a no-brainer. She says she had always admired Spelman and had a deep respect for the museum, which others are also starting to see. I think that in a post-2020 moment, there was a renewed or even brand new interest for a lot of people in learning from HBCUs, Andrews said. Museums like the one in Los Angeles, where Andrews previously worked, or even Atlanta's High Museum of Art, she said, have a lot to learn from these museums because the work that places like CAU, Spelman, have been doing around the arts for decades, the artists we've been upholding and exhibiting and collecting are the very artists who have been barred from showing at major institutions for a long time. The museums also serve an important mission, not just in the art they collect, but in who they educate. Taylor said the CAU Museum is often students' first exposure to an art museum. When students walk into Spelman's Art Museum, they see the cherrywood floors gleaming, the varnish shine to a mirror finish. The art on the walls reflects on the floor, as do the visitors, the two merging to create a new living tableau that reveals the ultimate truth of the AUC museums. Everyone is worthy of being considered an artist. Everyone is worthy of being considered art. That's where the treasure truly lies. That was the article titled, Museums at Atlanta HBCUs Hold a World Treasure. More than 1,600 works from some of the most influential black artists since the 1800s are in permanent collections. It was written by Bertha Donisdorick and published February 4, 2024 in the Atlanta Journal-Constitution newspaper. Next on today's African American Hour is a story titled Blaxit. Tired of racism, Black Americans try life in Africa. It was published February 16th in the New York Times newspaper and written by Colette Coleman. Jessica Washington lives in a 6-bedroom house on a hill with avocado trees and a spectacular view, not far from the rabbit farm she runs. For less than $50,000, Soshana Kurya-Zaraba and her husband built a 4-bedroom, 2-bathroom house on family farmland with goats, turkeys, and about 1,000 chickens. Mark and Marlene Bradley now call themselves islanders and the owners of 3 homes cooled by ocean breezes. All of them are Black Americans who found their new homes in Africa. They are enjoying the substantially lower cost of living and, more important, they said, the absence of the racism and discrimination they experienced in the United States. The COVID pandemic and the racial reckoning in the wake of the murder of George Floyd led some Black Americans to seek a different way of life abroad, in a movement that some are calling Blaxit. Those moving to Africa are also looking for an ancestral connection. Their migration is less about money and more about acceptance, a path that many intellectuals and artists have taken before. Today, a new life in Africa is open to people of varied professions who can work remotely. Immigration has been fueled by vocal proponents on social media and by government programs like Sierra Leone's Path to Citizenship and Ghana's Beyond the Return campaign. According to the Diaspora Affairs Office of Ghana, at least 1,500 African Americans moved to the country between 2019 and 2023. Despite the potential concerns for newcomers, including a wave of extreme anti-LGBTQ policies across the continent, Black Americans are still making the trip. Miss Washington, 46, of Houston, relocated to Rwanda in 2020. Mrs. Kurya-Zaraba, 40, moved to Uganda from Texas in 2021. The Bradleys, who are in their 60s, settled in Zanzibar in 2022. Ashley Cleveland, 39, a mother of 2 who runs a company that helps foreigners invest in and grow their businesses in Africa, relocated from Atlanta to Dar es Salaam, Tanzania, in 2020, and is now based in South Africa. She says she appreciates that in much of Africa, race is an abstract concept. Seeing Black African people on the money, on the billboards, you immediately eliminate your Blackness, she said. She welcomed this change for her children, who were 9 and 2 when they left the United States. Her older daughter, whose skin tone is deep brown, was no longer bullied because of her complexion, she said. The next section of the article is titled, We're at Home. The Exodus Club has been helping people in the African diaspora move to the continent since 2017. R.J. Mahdi, 38, a consultant for the group, moved from Ohio to Senegal 10 years ago. Mr. Mahdi said he had seen an increase in the number of Black Americans relocating to Africa in the past several years. There are 10 times as many coming now as there were 5 or 6 years ago, he said. By his estimate, demand for the Exodus Club's services has grown at least 20% every year since its founding, when it had about 30 clients. Becoming a repat felt empowering to Mr. Mahdi as a Black Muslim, he said. In the United States, about 14% of the population is Black, and just 2% of Black Americans are Muslim. In Senegal, however, nearly everyone is Black and Muslim. For more reasons than one, we're at home, he said. Mrs. Kurya-Zaraba, who is Jewish, said that when she moved to Uganda to join her husband, Israel Kurya, she went from being a minority within a minority to being surrounded by those who share her race and faith. Mrs. Kurya-Zaraba, who worked for a commercial real estate company in Texas, now runs Tikva Chadasha Foundation, a nonprofit supporting Ugandan women and disabled children. She and her husband live in Mbale, a small city that is home to the Abayudaya Jewish community, which has about 2,000 members. In the United States, Mrs. Kurya-Zaraba said, her identity came with qualifications. Other Black people would try to qualify my Blackness because I'm Jewish, and other Jews would try to qualify my Judaism because I'm Black. In Uganda, she no longer faces 1,000 cuts of racism, she said. For years, she had made accommodations, big and small, to try to control other people's perceptions, smiling to appear non-threatening, buying nicer clothes to avoid being mistaken for a domestic worker, and straightening her hair to be seen as more professional. She knew she had been acquiescing, but she said, "I didn't know the extent until I didn't have to do any of that." Mrs. Currier-Zaraba also went from a one-bedroom apartment in the States to a two-acre family compound in Uganda. Her home is a stone's throw from the homes of her parents-in-law and her sister-in-law and the large chicken coop. Her in-laws helped her husband build their house. "It's just so nice having all of this additional family support," she said. Africa isn't a refuge for all, though. Anti-LGBTQ sentiment is sweeping across the continent. In Uganda, the Anti-Homosexuality Act enacted last year punishes gay sex with life imprisonment and, in some cases, death. Similar bills have been introduced in other African countries such as Ghana and Kenya. Some LGBTQ people interviewed countered that the United States is no safe haven either. They pointed to violence against transgender people, a growing number of anti-LGBTQ bills, and the Human Rights Campaign declaration of a state emergency for LGBTQ Americans. These interviewees said that depending on what a person was looking for, and with discernment, Africa could still be a good option for LGBTQ people. But many people make the transatlantic exodus to stop fighting. Mr. Bradley, 63, who moved with his wife Marlene, 69, from Los Angeles to Rwanda in 2021 before settling in Zanzibar, said that arriving in Kigali felt like a load off my shoulders. Mr. Bradley, who noted that he and two of his four sons had experienced fraught encounters with the police in the United States, said he would never forget the lighthearted feeling he had when approaching an armed officer in Kigali to ask for directions. The officer greeted him with a smile. Mr. Bradley also felt relieved and safer in Africa. "You don't feel like you're looking over your shoulder," she said. The Bradleys, who have retirement visas and live on retirement income, now reside in a newly developed planned community on the island of Zanzibar, about 2 hours by ferry from Dar es Salaam. Most residents of the development were not born in the country. The community's homes range in price from $70,000 for a 430-square-foot one-bedroom to $750,000 for a 3,000-square-foot oceanfront villa. With the money the Bradleys would have spent on one home in Los Angeles, they were able to buy their three-bedroom, two-bath townhouse, an investment property, and a home for two of their sons to eventually live in. Miss Washington is still in awe of her new life in Rwanda. She works as an online teacher with students in South Carolina and has an agricultural visa that allows her to run a rabbit farm near her home outside Kigali. She shares her six-bedroom house with her 76-year-old mother. "I just never thought that a single woman with a teaching salary would be able to live in a space like this," she said. Her home, on an acre of land with avocado trees, cost $500 a month and required an initial six-month payment. Stipulations for upfront rental payments of several months, a year, or even longer are common. The move has given Miss Washington more room, physically and emotionally. "One of the things I wanted to get away from for just a little while was being a black woman," she said. The expectation that she be strong, because in America, black women are supposed to be strong, exhausted her. "I just wanted a space to be me." While in the United States, a $500 monthly rent may seem cheap, in Rwanda, it is a significant amount. In some cases, the large wealth gap between American immigrants and most Africans leads to friction. But in other cases, locals embrace the infusion of cash. Many governments court the diaspora for this exact purpose. Justin Ngoga, 39, founder of Impact Route, a company in Kigali that offers relocation services, said that there is little tension between expatriates like Miss Washington and locals. Unlike Portugal and Ghana, where an influx of foreigners drove up costs, Rwanda does not have enough newcomers to produce such a negative economic impact, Mr. Ngoga said. "We are still, I think, at the stage where we need more people to come," he said. "We need people to come and do active retirement here. We need investors. We need talents." Rashad McCrory, 44, acknowledged that he left his humble beginnings in the Polo Grounds Towers, an Upper Manhattan public housing complex, far behind when he relocated from Harlem to Ghana in 2020. Here we're rich, said Mr. McCrory, who published a guidebook for people moving to Africa. He said he tries to give back. He started a scholarship fund and built a soccer field for neighborhood children. Standing on his balcony in Elmina, Ghana, Mr. McCrory recalled the injustices he said he experienced in New York that spurred him to leave. Top of mind were the frequent stop and frisk, he said, which felt like the police groping and violating him and sometimes left him in tears. I'd rather have the moral dilemma of being in a higher class in the system of classism rather than being marginalized in the system of oppression and racism, he said. The next section of the article is titled, Not for Everybody. Some black Americans who move to Africa never get the resolution they sought. Adwoa Yeboa Asantewa Davis, 52, a therapist who moved from Washington, D.C. to Accra, Ghana in 2020, said that black Americans considering the move to escape racism should try therapy first, because the trauma of years of discrimination will not disappear with a change of setting and may even resurface when they are foreigners in Africa. You're coming here and you're expecting that everybody's black, so I'm going to be okay, Ms. Davis said. But then you get here and then you're being othered, viewed as different and separate. The othering goes both ways. Some Ghanaians feel discrimination from black Americans, said Ikua Atoll, 38, a Ghanaian in Accra. Black American communities there can be insular, she said, and their businesses often prefer to hire black Americans or Indians and Lebanese for senior positions, while qualified Ghanaians are excluded or underpaid. If you're leaving the U.S. to come to Ghana thinking about I'm coming to the motherland, at least treat us right, said Mrs. Atoll. And then there's the exodus back to the United States. Despite big plans for new homes and businesses, many black Americans who move to Africa do not stay. Omosede Iholoor, 31, moved to Accra in 2015 after becoming enamored of the city while studying abroad there. But she decided to leave in 2020 because she felt she was missing out on life back home in New York and the big events of family and friends. And she began to feel that the daily stresses around frequent power outages and cultural differences were changing her for the worse, making her quick to anger. How much of yourself are you losing in the process of trying to adapt to a culture, Mrs. Iholoor said. Ghana was not going to adapt her. Erica Bennett, 73, the founder of the nonprofit Diaspora Africa Forum, said that black Americans came to Ghana in droves in 2020, and they're still coming. But Ms. Bennett, who has lived in Africa for 40 years, said that many Americans are not cut out for life in Africa, and she urged those considering the move to visit first. Africa is not for everybody, she said. That was the article, Blaxit. Tired of racism, black Americans try life in Africa. It was written by Colette Coleman and published February 16, 2024 in the New York Times newspaper. My next reading is an obituary from the New York Times and its NewYorkTimes.com website. The title is, Charles V. Hamilton, an Apostle of Black Power, Dies at 94. It was written by Sam Roberts and published February 18, 2024. Charles V. Hamilton, a philosophical godfather of the Black Power movement, which he envisioned as the means to subvert what he stigmatized as America's institutional racism, died on November 18th in Chicago, it was recently confirmed. He was 94. A friend and colleague, the South African educator Wilmot James, said he learned of the death from a representative of Dr. Hamilton's bank. Dr. Hamilton's nephew, Kevin Lacey, said it had not been previously announced because Dr. Hamilton was a private and modest man and was concerned about what would and would not happen upon his passing. In 1967, Dr. Hamilton, a political scientist at Historically Black Colleges and Stokely Carmichael, who later adopted the name Kwame Ture, a leader of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, discombobulated the multiracial anti-discrimination crusade that was radiating from the South to northern cities at the time by publishing the manifesto, Black Power, The Politics of Liberation. Their book convulsed moderate and more conciliatory black groups like the NAACP nearly as much as it confounded the white liberals who had traditionally supported civil rights. Moreover, its conclusion that racism was embedded in the nation's institutions further antagonized white people who had opposed any preferences for black people in government policies to mitigate discrimination in housing, jobs, public accommodations, and education. Chuck was very definitely an intellectual alter ego to Stokely Carmichael, his friend J.C. Johnson, the former Secretary of Homeland Security, said in an interview. He was not a screamer. He was not a rebel. He was a quiet, dignified, soft-spoken, very progressive intellect behind the Black Power movement. He was content to have Stokely as the out-front person on their book. The strategy they envisioned was radical but nonviolent. It depended initially on black people recognizing their own self-worth and uniting behind a common agenda. His most important contribution to American history, Dr. Hamilton later said, was his exhortation in the book that before a group can enter the open society, it must first close ranks. That reference to closing ranks did not imply that he had given up on integration and was sounding a call for separatism. Rather, he said, for black people to belong to mainstream America, they had to understand that we are black people and not ashamed of that. Black power must work to establish legitimate new institutions that make participants, not recipients, out of a people traditionally excluded from the fundamentally racist processes of this country, he said. And institutions in black communities must be led by black people, as a challenge to the myth that black people are incapable of leadership. The point we are trying to make in this book is that one's individual stance in relationship to the black man is irrelevant, he told Studs Terkel in a radio interview in 1967. It's what the system does, and that's why we use the term institutional racism. While he emphasized that black power is a developmental process and cannot be an end in itself, he insisted that viable coalitions between black and white people would be sustainable only when white Americans agreed that those goals benefited the common good. Equitable distribution of power must come from a mutual self-interest, not altruism or guilt feelings, Dr. Hamilton wrote in the New York Times Magazine in 1968. It must be clear by now, he continued, that any society which had been color-conscious all its life to the detriment of a particular group cannot simply become colorblind and expect that group to compete on equal terms, he said. Black power was considered so incendiary that its publisher, Random House, insisted on a disclaimer of sorts just before the table of contents. This book presents a political framework and ideology which represents the last reasonable opportunity for this society to work out its racial problems short of prolonged destructive guerrilla warfare. That such violent warfare may be unavoidable is not herein denied. But if there is the slightest chance to avoid it, the politics of black power, as described in this book, is seen as the only viable hope. Less than a decade later, working within the Democratic Party as a strategist, Dr. Hamilton was criticized by more militant black people when he urged that the 1976 party platform be deracialized and promote benefits for disadvantaged people regardless of their color. An echo of Daniel Patrick Moynihan's recommendation in 1970 that the issue of race could benefit from a period of benign neglect. He meant that the repercussions of institutional racism, a term he popularized, should be addressed without mentioning race specifically to avoid a backlash from white voters, and that common ground be found to bring poor black and white people together. Charles Vernon Hamilton was born in Muskogee, Oklahoma on October 19, 1929, 10 days before the stock market crashed, heralding the Depression. His father, Owen, was a garage mechanic. His mother, Viola Haynes Hamilton, brought Charles, his older brother and younger sister, to Chicago's South Side in 1935. He aspired to be a journalist, but he realized the opportunities for him in that profession as a black man were few. He figured the civil service meant security, so he gravitated toward an interest in government. He would later serve as a foot soldier in Richard J. Daley's Cook County Democratic machine and work for the post office between teaching jobs. After serving in the military in the late 1940s when President Harry S. Truman integrated the armed forces, he graduated from Roosevelt University in Chicago with a degree in political science in 1951. He then enrolled in law school but did not stay there long, instead earning a master's degree from the University of Chicago in 1957. In 1958, he joined the faculty of the Historically Black Tuskegee Institute in Alabama. His contract was terminated in 1960. "I was too radical," he recalled in 2021. "I got fired from Tuskegee because I was teaching the kids how to contact Congress and march in protest. I never wanted to just be a professor," he said in an interview with the Annual Review of Political Science in 2018. "No, that was not it. I wanted to turn my academic life into an activist one." He returned to the University of Chicago, where he earned his doctorate in 1964. He then taught at Rutgers University in New Jersey, Lincoln University in Pennsylvania, and Roosevelt University before finding his home in 1969 at Columbia University in New York, where he was named the Wallace S. Sayer Professor of Government and Political Science. He lived in New Rochelle, New York, and retired from the Columbia faculty in 1998. While he eventually hoped to move to South Africa, he lived in assisted care facilities in the New York metropolitan area until he moved to Chicago to be closer to a niece. Dr. Hamilton published a biography, Adam Clayton Powell, Jr., The Political Biography of an American Dilemma, in 1991. The Pulitzer Prize-winning historian Taylor Branch wrote in the New York Times Book Review that Dr. Hamilton's diligent scholarship has uncovered more than a good book's worth of Powell material. Dr. Hamilton later said that Mr. Powell, a Harlem congressman who was reelected after he was ousted for ethics violations by the House of Representatives, was a scoundrel. "We should have called him out, but we didn't," he said in 2018. "We protected him." Among Dr. Hamilton's other books was The Dual Agenda, Race and Social Welfare Policies of Civil Rights Organizations, 1997, which he wrote with his wife Donna Cooper Hamilton, a professor at Lehman College in New York. She died in 2015. He is survived by a stepdaughter, Valley Hamilton. His daughter, Carol, who was press secretary to Commerce Secretary Ronald H. Brown, died in 1996 when a plane carrying Mr. Brown and others crashed in Croatia. In Black Power, Dr. Hamilton and Mr. Carmichael challenged the sociologist Gunnar Myrdal's premise that there was an American dilemma between the nation's liberal ideals and the miserable conditions in which so many black people lived. If anything, the author suggested, most Americans subordinated conscience to quotidian self-interest. The fact is that people lived their daily lives making practical day-to-day decisions about their jobs, homes, children, they wrote. And in a profit-oriented, materialistic society, there is little time to reflect on creeds, especially if it could mean more job competition, lower property values, and the daughter marrying a Negro. There is no American dilemma, no moral hang-up, Dr. Hamilton and Mr. Carmichael wrote, and black people should not base decisions on the assumption that a dilemma exists. That was an obituary titled, Charles V. Hamilton, an apostle of black power, dies at 94. He popularized the term institutional racism, and with Stokely Carmichael wrote a book in 1967 that was seen as a radical manifesto. This obituary was written by Sam Roberts, published February 18, 2024, and it appeared at the New York Times NYTimes.com website. My next story is titled, African American Episcopal Church Leaders Call for a Halt to All U.S. Funding of Israel. This was published by the Religion News Service at the religionnews.com website. It was written by Adele Banks and published February 16, 2024. The African Methodist Episcopal Church's top officials have called for the U.S. government to halt all its funding of Israel, citing the deaths of tens of thousands of Palestinians in the Hamas-Israel war. The Council of Bishops of the African Methodist Episcopal Church calls on the United States government to immediately withdraw all funding and other support from Israel, reads a statement issued on Wednesday, February 14th, the 264th anniversary of the birth of the historically black denomination's founder, Richard Allen. Since October 7, 2023, in retaliation for the brutal murder of 1,139 Israeli citizens by Hamas, Israel has murdered over 28,000 Palestinians, mostly women and children. The United States is supporting this mass genocide. This must not be allowed to continue. The statement was signed by Bishop Adam J. Richardson, senior bishop of the denomination, Bishop Stafford Wicker, president of the Bishops' Council, Bishop E. Ann Henning Byfield, chair of Social Action, and Bishop Francine Brookins, co-chair of Social Action. Bishop Harry Seawright, the leader of the AME's Alabama district, said in a Thursday interview with Religion News Service that he and other bishops also supported the statement, which he said reflects the denomination's stances on social action. "We have always tried to take a social stand against injustice, unfair treatment of all people," he said. Seawright said he was not aware of any other black denominations that had adopted the same stance. Bishop Vashti McKenzie, a retired AME bishop and the president of the National Council of Churches, an organization of Protestant, Orthodox, Evangelical, and historically African-American churches, told Religion News Service that she believed the AME Church was the first national denomination to take this step. In January, Progressive National Baptist Convention President David Peoples declared his denomination's stance in favor of a ceasefire at a news conference at the Lorraine Motel, the Memphis, Tennessee site where the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. was assassinated in 1968. But on Thursday, he told RNS he was not taking the stance the AME Church has. "I'm not going that far," he said, though he said he agrees with those who think U.S. military funding to Israel should be tied to verified humanitarian conditions in an exit strategy. The AME statement comes in a week of continuing calls for ceasefire and humanitarian aid for the victims of the war that began on October 7th with a Hamas attack that killed an estimated 1,200 people in Israel, according to authorities there. 28,000 Palestinians have since been killed in retaliation, health officials in Gaza estimate. In a Monday, February 12th letter to House Speaker Mike Johnson, a diverse group of faith leaders requested that any legislation providing U.S. funding for Israel include humanitarian aid for Palestinians. The signers include leaders of the NCC, National Association of Evangelicals, the Religious Action Center for Reform Judaism, Network Lobby for Catholic Social Justice, Sojourners, the National African American Clergy Network, and Masjid Muhammad in Washington. "Ending the extraordinary suffering and death of Palestinian civilians is essential to Israel's long-term security and to peace and stability in the region," wrote the signatories, who added that they recognize Israel's right to defend itself and they seek the release of hostages held by Hamas. "On behalf of many faith groups, we stand united in our call to Congress to act immediately to make sure critical supplies and medicine are provided and delivered to those in need," the statement said. As the AME bishops issued their statement, peace pilgrimage marchers, including Christians, Jews, and Muslims, joined with the organization Faith for Black Lives on a trek from Philadelphia to Washington to urge an end to the war. On the same day, which was Ash Wednesday, dozens of Christian protesters protested outside the White House, where a Catholic Mass was said as part of an ecumenical witness in support of a ceasefire. In November, more than 900 black Christian leaders took out a full-page ad in the New York Times calling for a ceasefire and the release of Israeli hostages in Gaza. Shortly after the October 7th start of the war, other historically black denominations issued statements. Church of God in Christ presiding Bishop J. Drew Scherge said in an October 9th statement, "My heart goes out to the state of Israel. We are deeply concerned for the well-being of its people. We believe in the power of love and peace and offer our prayers for peace, security, and prosperity." The Board of Bishops of the African Methodist Episcopal Zion Church expressed lament over the violence affecting Jews, Muslim, and Christian people in the region. "Persons of moral clarity can fiercely condemn acts of terrorism by Hamas while also speaking out against the collective punishment of the people of Gaza and the life-threatening conditions imposed upon the Palestinian population," the AME Zion bishop said in an October 17th statement. "Israeli and Palestinian lives are of equal value, and each of their lives matter." That was the article, "African Methodist Episcopal Church Leaders Call for Halt to All U.S. Funding of Israel." It was published February 16th, 2024, written by Adele M. Banks, and appeared at the ReligionNews.com website. Next, I have a report from the Pew Research Center and its pewresearch.org website. The title is A Look at Black-Owned Businesses in the United States. It was written by Rebecca Leopard and published February 16, 2024. More than 1 in 5 black adults in the United States say owning a business is essential to financial success, according to a September 2023 Pew Research Center survey. While black-owned businesses have grown significantly in the United States in recent years, they still make up a small share of overall firms and revenue, according to our analysis of federal data. In 2021, there were 161,031 U.S. firms with majority black or African-American ownership, up from 124,004 in 2017, according to the latest estimates from the Annual Business Survey conducted by the U.S. Census Bureau and the National Science Foundation. Black-owned firms' gross revenue soared by 43% during this time span, from an estimated $127.9 billion in 2017 to $183.3 billion in 2021. Despite this growth, majority black-owned businesses made up only about 3% of all U.S. firms that were classifiable by the race and ethnicity of their owners in 2021, and they accounted for just 1% of gross revenue from all classifiable companies that year. By comparison, in 2021, roughly 14% of all Americans were black. As has long been the case, white majority-owned businesses made up the greatest share of classifiable firms, 85%, and their revenue, 93%, in 2021. About 1 in 10 classifiable firms, 11%, were majority owned by Asian Americans, and no more than 7% had majority ownership by someone from another racial and ethnic group. How many workers do black-owned businesses employ? Black or African-American majority-owned firms provided income for roughly 1.4 million workers in 2021. Their annual payrolls were estimated at $53.6 billion. Still, most black-owned firms tend to be smaller businesses. Two-thirds had fewer than 10 employees in 2021. 13% had 10 to 49 employees, and just 3% had 50 or more. Another 16% reported having no employees. The ABS determines employment size by the number of paid workers during the March 12th pay period. What's the most common sector for black-owned businesses? By far, healthcare and social assistance. About 45,000 of the roughly 161,000 U.S. companies with majority black or African-American ownership, or 28% of the total, were part of this sector in 2021. Looked at a different way, 7% of all classifiable U.S. businesses in the healthcare and social assistance sector were majority black-owned that year. Other common sectors that year included professional, scientific, and technical services, comprising 14% of all black-owned businesses, administrative and support, and waste management and remediation services, 8%, transportation and warehousing, 8%, retail trade, 6%, construction, 6%. Where are black-owned businesses located? Most black or African-American majority-owned businesses, 87%, are located in urban areas. Just 5% are in rural areas, that is, places with fewer than 2,500 inhabitants under the Census Bureau's definition. Some of the most populous states also have the greatest number of black majority-owned businesses. Florida had 18,502 such businesses in 2021, California had 15,041, and Georgia had 14,394. Black majority-owned businesses made up the greatest share of all classifiable firms in the District of Columbia, 15%, Georgia and Maryland, 8% each. Who are black business owners? They're more likely to be men than women. Some 53% of black-owned firms in 2021 had men as their majority owners, while 39% had women majority owners. Another 8% had equal male-female ownership. The gender gap is larger among classifiable U.S. firms overall. 63% were majority owned by men in 2021, 22% were majority owned by women, and 14% had equal male-female ownership. They tend to be middle-aged. Roughly half, 49% of Black or African-American business owners who reported their age group were ages 35 to 54 in 2021. Another 28% were 55 to 64, and just 7% were younger than 35. A majority have a college degree. Among owners who reported their highest level of education completed, and 34% had a graduate or professional degree in 2021. What motivates Black entrepreneurs? When asked to choose from a list of reasons why they opened their firm, about 9 in 10 Black or African American majority owners who responded said an important reason was the opportunity for greater income, a desire to be their own boss, or wanting the best avenue for their ideas, goods, and services. Balancing work and family life, 88%, and having flexible hours, 85%, were also commonly cited. For most Black or African American majority owners, their business is their primary source of income. 7 in 10 of those who reported income information in 2021 said this was the case. That was the Pew Research Center report titled, A Look at Black-Owned Businesses in the United States. It was published February 16, 2024, and written by Rebecca Leppert. That's all the time we have this week. If you would like to listen to this program again or past editions of the African American Hour, you can find them wherever you get your podcasts or in the archives at the Audio Reader website at reader.ku.edu. I'm Byron Buckner, and thank you for listening to the African American Hour. Thank you.